There are a great many visitors I would like to acknowledge this morning. I cannot acknowledge all of them, but I would like to mention that some members of the Martin Lyle family are present with us today. I conducted funeral services for Martin yesterday, and I just learned that the parents of Bob Scott are visiting from Western Kansas and found them out there. I have known them for a long, long time. And I can tell you in absolute sincerity that if you want to meet two people who exemplify everything that is good about the state of Kansas, meet Robert and Jesse Scott after the service is over and talk to them about their son's inability to get his stove fixed properly before he gets home. The Gospel of John is so different that it is a world to itself. And I've chosen on this Palm Sunday to enter that world instead of the more familiar one of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. According to John, the public career of Jesus was pretty much a failure. We are so success-oriented that we don't like to hear that. But John says that the people around Jerusalem and throughout the important province of Judea simply did not believe in the prophet from Nazareth. And so Jesus left his friends and went away and hid himself. I'm always wanting to read between the lines, so I wonder why he did that. Was he depressed? Did he need to get himself under control? The answer belongs among the million mysteries of the Bible. We are teased, not told. But he had been more popular among the country people, who were not as sophisticated as their city cousins. And so in his last few days, when he came into Jerusalem to celebrate the feast of the Passover, there were two very different responses to him. The pillars of the Jewish church and the well-to-do thought he was a dangerous threat to peace and to their security. But the Galilean peasants who had flooded into town for the holidays liked him and decided to give their hometown friend a royal welcome. So they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him, crying, "Hosanna, blessed be he who comes in the name of the Lord." Who knows what they meant? We have to remind ourselves how fickle these crowds were. No wise person ever gets unduly excited about the applause of the multitude. It can turn to scorn while the echoes of the shouts are still reverberating in the rafters. Jesus understood that, sober realist that he was. And instead of hyping people up, which is the technique of modern evangelism, he had a way of calling them back to the way things really were, telling them what the cost would be, that they would suffer if they followed his way, that he was not the kind of king they thought he was. And as John tells the story of the last days, he has Jesus think out loud. "Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour?" Most of the time when we read about great figures in history, we see them when their minds are made up, their course set, their resolution hardened. We don't see them when they are hesitating, wondering what to do next. We don't overhear them when they ask themselves the hard questions we save for private moments. But John lets us invade the privacy of the mind of Jesus, lets us encounter someone with a heart like ours who has to fight doubt and uncertainty with the same weapons we have to use: courage, hope, trust. A man, one verse tells us, who was tempted in every way just as we are. Isn't that a comfort to some of us? And so, tempted now in the shadow of the cross to panic, to run, to wonder why his dream is dying before it fairly gets started. Now is my soul troubled. How many times have we thought those words facing the loss of a job, of a child, of youth and strength and beauty, of our health to some damnable disease? Now is my soul troubled. I'm glad John lets me hear that sigh. I feel closer to a real person. Every week I say or feel those words, watching a dear friend undergo chemotherapy, getting a phone call about a mysterious illness that may force early retirement for a man too skilled at his job for us to lose him, hearing his wife say, "Now is my soul troubled." Some of you came this morning with those words trembling on the edge of your tongue, held back only because you choose to hide your sorrows. And if not this day, if things seem bright along with the promise of spring this day, how many mornings ago was it that you said it last? "Now is my soul troubled." So that touches a chord in the ragged symphony of our days. And so does what comes next when John tells us that this man we call Jesus called himself out of his doubt and back to serenity and strength with the words, "My job in this world is to trust and glorify God, and whatever that takes, I will do." Words we also can speak in some of our best moments. Words as bracing and heroic this day as they were yesterday on some dusty back road in Jerusalem. How nice it is to know that he was staggered for a moment before, in the words of my college kids, he got it all together. So the model is there to teach us to go on with quiet courage, to do whatever work we have to do, to face the world with wisdom and love after our hearts are broken, to become part of that vast army of people who keep their sorrows mostly hidden and greet the day and smile and do their jobs without complaining. I think of those noble letters in which old Dr. Samuel Johnson, with never a whisper of complaint or a single bleat of self-pity, faced the horrors of paralysis that had come suddenly upon him. A tonic to read, those letters. And better still to read the entry Thomas Carlyle made in his diary on that awful night when John Stuart Mill told him that the whole manuscript of the French Revolution which Carlyle had lent him before publication, had been accidentally burned to ashes. The work of years wiped out in a few minutes. Now is my soul troubled, the old Scot surely thought. But managing to say that it was as if his invisible schoolmaster had torn his copybook when it was handed in and said, "No, lad, you have to write it better." And so said Carlyle, "What can I do? Sorrowing, but obey. Obey and think it is best to go back to work," which he did. And in his own view, wrote his book better the second time. You may think, when I smile at the thought that Ollie North and John Poindexter and Secord and Hakim are heroes, that I have no heroes, but I have. All the nameless people who pick up the broken pieces of their lives and go on. I can look around this room and name 20 people as fast as I can say their names who to me are truly heroic. So Jesus, whose soul was troubled, hitched up his will and went on to sit down with his friends in that upper room they had borrowed for the night. And the story now reads like this. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Do those words skip past your ear without pause? Or do they come in and sit down on the couch? Do you hear what they say? That this man's love was invincible. That it went right on loving those who were not very lovely. And did so to the bitter end. I got to wondering the other day as I was on that drive to school or church, what I would say if somebody asked me the one thing about my mother that I would remember with the most gratitude and never forget. It didn't take long because I had known the answer most of my life. She was the first person in the world. I'm not sure that even my father was able to do this. To give me absolute, unconditional, invincible love. I never had to worry about it. I might be slow to write or to visit. I might live beneath her hopes for me, but her love never changed, never altered by so much as a breath. I didn't understand as a child how important that is to the rest of one's life, that there is someone who is going to love you without reservation, no matter what you do, who may be saddened, hurt, disappointed, but who will love you anyway and forgive until there is nothing you can do finally except return that kind of love. So with this marvelous man whose life was so compelling that they came to call him the Son of God, having loved his own, he loved them to the end. It must have been tough to love those rough and ready fishermen and that tax collector and Simon, the fanatical freedom fighter, and Judas, who sold out, these people he called who failed him moment by moment, but he did it anyway. And although we are ahead of ourselves, by a week, who knows? Maybe that's what really made the resurrection possible. So that after he was gone, they finally realized what that kind of love was, and he was reborn in their heads and became invulnerable in their hearts, so that all the rest of their lives they could say and know exactly what they meant. He lives. So the story of the upper room is that he won't accept our betrayals. We break away and wander off. He follows and finds us. Through some verse we hear, some person who loves us, some sermon heard by accident, some film we see or novel we read on vacation, how can I list all the ways in which the voice of goodness speaks, pulling us back to our best selves? And then, in this story of those final hours, John does something no other gospel writer does. He completely ignores the story of the bread and the wine. That business that in the history of the church turned into the Lord's Supper. No scholar I have ever read pretends to understand exactly why John would have left out totally a story so important to the community of faith. But he did. And instead of joining Matthew, Mark, and Luke to tell us for the fourth time about the sacrament of communion, he tells us about something else, the sacrament that almost made it. I don't know why he chose to be so different, unless he wanted to teach a lesson about humility that the church could remember when it was tempted to try to outdo the world in the uses of power and wealth and ambition. Before this night, walking on the roads from town to town, the disciples had quarreled over which ones would be favored in the coming kingdom. Were they doing that again as they came in on this night, turning their heads away deliberately from the pitcher and the basin and the towel set by the door, unwilling to sponge off one another's hot, dusty feet in the usual courtesy? Was the room sullen and quiet, with each man saying to himself, if they think they'll get the top spots when I've done as much as anyone, well, they can sit there forever before I'll touch their feet? And if so, did Jesus suddenly realize that whatever he had to say that night would be useless with them in that mood, so that something dramatic would have to wake them up? No one knows. All we know is that only John recalls for us the unforgettable moment when Jesus got up, put a towel around his waist, poured water into the basin, and went from one to the other, kneeling to wash their feet and wipe them with the towel. If we're right, and they had been sulking, think of the embarrassment. Deep silence in that room until Jesus comes at last to Peter, always so impulsive, never tongue-tied, and who could not stand what was happening. First a stare of disbelief, and then the stammering question, Master, do you really intend to wash my feet? And Jesus saying, what I do now, you don't understand, but later on, you will. Later was never Peter's favorite word. So he says defiantly, you shall never wash my feet. I won't have it. And we like him because we know what he means and that his heart is right. But Jesus insists solemnly, if I don't do this, you have no part in me. And if I have washed your feet, then you should also wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Don't you think it's interesting that literalists stop being literalists when they read those words? Dear friends of mine who claim to take every word in the Bible literally, do not take this strong, clear commandment literally. And they say very cheerfully, oh, you can fulfill the spirit of this commandment by doing something else that makes the same point. I agree with them, but it is a courteous freedom they may not allow the rest of us when it comes to baptism or to some verse about the second coming. The truth is that some of these things caught on with the church and some didn't. And foot washing as a condition of discipleship was one of the things that didn't. It's probably just as well. Church property committees would have trouble with pans of water on the new carpet in the chancel. Theologians would have us caught up in endless debate over whether the feet should be immersed or sprinkled. And denominations would split over whether the right foot or the left foot should be washed first. There are good people who've been taught to be so literal-minded about what they read that they can't help falling into traps like these. But our own faith is that it's more important to know what Jesus meant by what he did than to try to recreate every event of his life. And surely the last thing he meant is that we have to get a basin and a towel and do this first century ritual or we can't be a part of the kingdom. What he meant was, if you don't interpret this thing I do and learn to be humble, then my life has failed you. You have missed the whole point of it. It was not Peter's feet that were soiled, but his mind, all tangled up in dreams of prestige and power. And Peter, being just as literal-minded as we are sometimes, said, well, if this basin bit is a good thing, why stop with my feet? Wash my hands, too, and my head. He missed the point. But we shouldn't feel smug. We miss it over and over because we read as literally, as literal-mindedly as he once listened. We're not required to obey an inflexible set of 15 rules or follow without imagination some ancient model, but to grow up into the Spirit of Christ, confronting every day of our lives with a passion for justice, with mercy and forgiveness for those who falter, and with an unconditional love for those around us that will not give up on them until that kind of love, so rare in this world, has won them and freed them to be the best they can. If we do that, the sacrament that never caught on in a literal way will have made its point in another way, and we will have knelt down in spirit and done what he did that night in the upper room, and our whole lives will become a sacrament, which is what he had in mind.